39. Fine words, those, to the tiger. 9/10 of the city was still strange to her, but Nadia had mastered the geography lesson that so many Russian women have learned to their sorrow, the location of Moscow's prisons. They were, she found, numerous and thoughtfully dotted about the capital at regular intervals, so that you need never be very far from one. Delivering parcels for Gleb, inquiring after him, visiting him, she had learned to distinguish the big Lyubyanka, which catered to the whole Soviet Union, from the little Lyubyanka, which served only the Moscow oblast. She learned, too, that every station had its detention cells. She had been in Butyrki and Taganka prisons a time or two, and knew which trams to take. The timetables were no help, for Lefortova and Krasnaya Presnya. She herself lived hard by Matruskaya Tishina, a prison abolished at the time of the revolution, but re-established and reinforced later on. Since Gleb had been sent back from a distant prison camp to Moscow, and not to a camp this time, but to a remarkable institution called a special prison, where they were well-fed and employed on scientific research, Nadia had started seeing her husband again from time to time. But wives were not supposed to know where exactly their husbands were kept. So husbands were brought in for these rare meetings to one or another of the Moscow prisons. Visits to the Taganka were the cheeriest. This was a prison for common criminals, not political prisoners, and the regimen there was easy-going. Prisoners and visitors met in the guards club. Prisoners were brought along the deserted street of the Masons in an open bus. Wives would be waiting for them on the pavement, and before the visit officially began, a man could embrace his wife, remain with her, tell her things not allowed by the rules, and even pass things to her. Arrangements during the visit were just as casual. Husbands and wives sat side by side. There was only one pair of guard's ears for every four couples. Butyrki was another cheerful, easy-going prison. It struck a chill into the wives, but prisoners who ended up there after the Lyubyanka were delighted by the general laxity. The light in the boxes was not blinding. You could walk along hallways without keeping your hands behind your back, talk in a normal voice in your cell, look out under the muzzles on windows, lie on the plank bed in the daytime, or even sleep underneath it. Butyrki was soft in other ways, too. You could sleep with your hands under your overcoat. Your glasses were not taken away for the night. Matches were allowed in cells. They didn't gut every cigarette of its tobacco. And loaves, sent in by your family, were only cut in four, not into little pieces. But wives knew nothing of these indulgences. They saw a fortress wall four times the height of a man, stretching a whole block along Novoslobodskaya Street. They saw iron gates between mighty concrete pillars, and no ordinary gates at that, opening automatically in a slow yawn to admit prison trucks, and automatically closing behind them. Women visitors passed on admission through an opening in a stone wall 2 meters thick, and were conducted around the grim Pugachev Tower between walls several times a man's height. Ordinary zeks saw their visitors through two sets of bars, with a guard pacing between them as though he himself were caged, while zeks of the higher category, Sharashka people, and their visitors, faced each other across a wide table with a solid partition underneath it so that feet could not touch and exchange signals, and with a guard standing like an unblinking effigy at the side of the table, listening to the conversation. But the most oppressive feature of Butyrki was that husbands seemed to materialize from the depths of the jail, exhaled by those thick, damp walls for half an hour to reassure their wives, like smiling ghosts, that they were comfortable and wanted for nothing, and then melting into those walls again. This was the first time Nadia had visited Gleb in Lefortovo. The senior guard checked off her name on his list and pointed toward an annex. Several women were already waiting in a bare room with two long benches and a bare table. A wicker basket and shopping bags, evidently full of eatables, stood on the table. Although prisoners in the Sharashka were adequately fed, Nadia, who had brought only some light pastry straws in a paper bag, felt resentful and ashamed that she couldn't treat her husband to something tasty even once a year. She had gotten up early, while the others in the dormitory were still asleep, to make these straws with all that was left of her flour, sugar, and butter rations. She hadn't had time to buy sweets or cakes, and anyway had very little money until she could draw her grant. Visiting day coincided with her husband's birthday, and she had nothing to give him. A good book? She couldn't even do that after her last visit. She had brought him a little volume of Yesenin's poems, gotten hold of it by a miracle. He had had an identical copy at the front, and it had disappeared when he was arrested. Alluding to this, Nadia had written on the title page, "So shall all else that you have lost return to you." But Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev had ripped the inscribed page out in her presence and returned it to her, remarking that nothing in writing could be passed to prisoners. Texts must go through the censor separately. When Gleb heard this, he ground his teeth and asked her not to bring any more books. Four women sat around the table, one a young woman with a three-year-old girl. Nadia didn't know any of them. They acknowledged her greeting and continued their animated conversation. A woman of 35 or 40, in a fur coat that was far from new and a threadbare headscarf, sat on a short bench against the opposite wall with her legs crossed and arms folded. Her whole pose expressed her determination to avoid all contact and conversation. There was nothing resembling a parcel anywhere near her. The company at the table would have made room for Nadia, but she did not feel like joining them. She, too, wanted to be alone with her thoughts that morning. She went over to the woman sitting by herself and said, "Do you mind?" There was barely room for two on the bench. The woman raised her eyes. They were quite colourless. They showed no understanding of Nadia's question. They looked at Nadia and beyond her. Nadia sat down, tucked her hands into her sleeves, inclined her head to one side so that her cheek sank into her imitation Astrakhan collar, and sat as still as her neighbour. At that moment she didn't want to think about anything except Gleb, the conversation they would shortly be having, and something extending from the dim past into the invisible future, something that was not Gleb or Nadia but the two of them together, something usually called by the hackneyed word love. But she was unable to shut out the talk around the table. They were telling each other what their husbands were given to eat morning and evening, how often underwear was washed in prison. How did they know? Surely they didn't waste the precious minutes of a visit on such things. They enumerated the foodstuffs they had brought, so many grams of this, so many kilos of that. All this was an example of that stubborn womanly solicitude that makes a family, and keeps the human race going. But Nadia's thought was different, that it was an insult to reduce what should be great moments to the humdrum, the miserable small change of every day. Did it never occur to these women to ask themselves who had dared to imprison their husbands? After all, their husbands need never have been behind bars, need never have been forced to eat prison food. It was a long wait. They had been told to come at 10, but 11 o'clock came, and still no one had appeared. A seventh visitor, a woman with grey hair, arrived late and out of breath. Nadia knew her from a previous visit. She was the engraver's wife, his third and also his first. She was very ready to tell her story. She had always adored her husband and thought him very talented. But one day he announced that he disliked her psychological profile, abandoned her and their child, and went off with another woman. He lived 3 years with this other, the redhead. Then he was called up. He was taken prisoner almost immediately, but he had lived in Germany as a free man and, alas, had affairs there too. On his way back home, he was arrested at the frontier and sentenced to 10 years. He let the redhead know that he was in Butyrki and asked her to send food parcels, but she had said, "If he'd betrayed me and not his motherland, I would find it easier to forgive him." After that, he had pleaded with his first wife. She had started visiting and sending parcels, and now he kept begging her forgiveness and swearing eternal love. A bitter remark made by the engraver's wife had echoed in Nadia's mind. "I dare say the best thing for us to do is to be unfaithful to our husbands while they're in jail. Then they'll appreciate us when they come out. Otherwise, they'll think nobody wanted us, nobody would have us while they were away." This had stayed with Nadia, because she sometimes thought the same herself. On this occasion, too, The new arrival gave a fresh twist to the conversation around the table. She started talking about the trouble she had had with the lawyers on Nikolskaya Street. They had long styled themselves the Model Legal Aid Bureau. But lawyers belonging to it charged thousands, spent a lot of time in Moscow restaurants, and left their clients' affairs to look after themselves. The day came when they got on the wrong side of somebody or other, were arrested, and were given 10 years all around. The Model sign was taken down, but the Bureau, though no longer Model, was replenished with new legal advisers who, just like their predecessors, charged thousands and left their clients' affairs to look after themselves. They explained in confidence that big fees were necessary because they had to share them. They were charging not just for themselves. The business had to pass through many hands. The concrete wall of the law was like that of Butyrki, 4 times a man's height. Women could not take wing and flutter over it. They could only walk around it, humbly pleading with some little gate to open. The course of legal proceedings behind the wall of the law was like the mysterious workings of an awesome machine, which, though the guilt of the accused was evident, though the accused was pitted against the government, might at times miraculously spit out a winning lottery ticket. The women paid lawyers not for a win, but for their dream of winning. The engraver's wife believed implicitly that she would win in the end. It emerged from what she had said that she had amassed 40,000 rubles by selling her room and from contributions made by relatives, and had used it to overpay 4 lawyers in succession. 3 petitions for clemency had been lodged, and 5 appeals on the substance of the case. She had followed the progress of all these appeals closely, and had been given many assurances of a favourable review. She knew by name all the regular attorneys in the 3 main offices of the Public Prosecutor's Department, and was acclimatized to the waiting rooms of the Supreme Court and the Supreme Soviet. As trustful people, and especially women, will, she attached exaggerated importance to every encouraging remark and every look that was not actually hostile. "You have to write. Write to anybody and everybody," she insisted, urging other women to dash off down the same path. "Our husbands are suffering. They won't be freed without an effort. You must write." This talk took Nadia out of herself, but also touched a sore spot. The engraver's aging wife spoke with such passion that it was easy to believe her. She had stolen a march on them all, been cleverer than any of them. She would undoubtedly get her husband out of prison. Nadia began to reproach herself. "What about me? Why couldn't I have done the same? Why haven't I been as loyal a wife?" She had only once had dealings with a Model legal aid office, drawn up only 1 appeal with a lawyer's help, and paid him only 2,500, which was probably too little. He had no doubt taken offence and done nothing. "That's right," she said quietly, almost to herself. "Have we done all we can? Are our consciences clear?" Those at the table did not hear her above the general conversation. But her neighbour looked around sharply, as though Nadia had elbowed her or insulted her. "What can we do?" she said angrily, emphasising every word. "That's all moonshine. Article 58 means detain indefinitely. Article 58 means you're not just a criminal, you're the enemy. You can't buy your way out of Article 58 for a million." The lines in her face were deeper. Her voice had the ring of incurable suffering. Nadia's heart went out to the older woman. The tone of her voice seemed to apologize for what might sound like a pretentious reply. "What I meant was that we do not sacrifice ourselves completely. The wives of the Decembrists spared themselves nothing. They gave up everything to follow their husbands. If we can't hope to free them, perhaps we can get their sentences commuted to banishment? If he was sent to the very depths of the Tiger beyond the Arctic Circle, I would be content to follow him. I would give up everything." The woman with the austere face of a nun under her shabby grey headscarf looked at Nadia with surprise and respect. "You still feel strong enough to go to the Tiger? How fortunate you are. I no longer have the strength for anything. The way I feel, if some well-off old man would have me, I would marry him." "Could you abandon your husband? while he was behind bars. The woman took Nadia by the sleeve. "My dear girl, love was easy in the 19th century. Did any one of the Decembrists' wives really perform such a heroic feat? Did she have personnel departments challenging her to answer questionnaires? Did she have to conceal her marriage like a plague sore, or risk being sacked and deprived of the 500 roubles a month which was her sole income? Was she ostracized in a communal apartment, hissed at as an enemy of the people when she went to the pump in the yard? Did her own mother and sisters urge her to be sensible and divorce her husband? On the contrary, wherever they went, the Decembrist wives were accompanied by the admiring murmurs of the best people. Their heroic legend was a gift they graciously bestowed on poets. When they set off for Siberia in their own expensive carriages, they did not lose their Moscow residence permits, and with them the 9 square meters of living space that was all that was left to them, nor did they have to worry about trivial problems ahead, like a black mark in a labour book, living in something the size of a cupboard, having no saucepan, not even a crust of black bread. Fine words, those, to the tiger. Anyway, you may not have all that long to wait. Her voice seemed about to break. Her passionate eloquence brought tears into Nadia's eyes. She tried to excuse herself. "My husband's been in prison nearly 5 years," she said. "And before that, he was at the front."
"That doesn't count," the woman retorted. "Being at the front isn't the same thing. Waiting is easy, then. Everybody else is waiting, too. You can talk about it openly. You can read his letters to people. But when you have to wait and keep quiet about him, that's something else."
She said no more. She could see that Nadia didn't need to be told about it. By now it was 11:30. Lieutenant Colonel Klementev came in at last, accompanied by the sour, fat Sergeant Major. The Sergeant Major began checking parcels, opening packages of factory biscuits, and breaking homemade cakes in two. He even broke Nadia's pastry straws, looking for the note, the money, or the poison that might have been baked inside them. Klementev, meanwhile, collected all the permits, entered the visitors' names in a big book, then drew himself up as though on parade and made an announcement in his precise way. "Attention, please. You know the rules. The visit lasts 30 minutes. Nothing must be passed directly to prisoners. Nothing must be accepted from prisoners. It is forbidden to question prisoners about their work, their living conditions, and their daily routine. Any infringement of these rules is punishable as a criminal offence. Furthermore, shaking hands and kissing are forbidden as of today. If this rule is broken, the visit is terminated immediately." The women remained silent. Klementev called the first name.
"Gerasimovich, Natalia Pavlovna."
Nadia's neighbour rose and went out into the hallway, walking clumsily in her pre-war felt boots.